funds for the California Report are provided by Chevron, investing in renewables, strengthening communities, and creating jobs. More information available at chevron.com. The California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. URSCorp.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, the Japanese earthquake and tsunami unleashed destruction along the California coast as Japanese Americans here worry about loved ones back home.
We've tried to call to my parents thousands of times since the last night, but never get through. All the phone lines are dead.
Also, how fighting wildfires would change under Jerry Brown's plan to balance the budget. Plus, why rural radio stations are fretting about possible cuts to federal funding. And in Santa Barbara, celebrating the best music you've never heard.
It's an unparalleled experience, that incredible, exquisite feeling that comes over you when you're in the presence of someone who's just playing their heart out.
It's the California Report. The scenes of devastation coming out of Japan following that 9.0 magnitude earthquake are riveting and heartbreaking. And while it's more than 5,000 miles from Japan to California, emotional and physical aftershocks are being felt on this side of the Pacific. In downtown Los Angeles, Little Tokyo, with its Japanese-style buildings, Buddhist temples, and ramen shops, people there focused on the news. At Koraku Ramen, Japanese Americans sat, ate, talked, and tried not to worry about their relatives back home. 46-year-old Christina Reese and her husband run a boutique in West L.A.
We've tried to call to my parents thousands of times since the last night, but never get through. All the phone lines are dead still.
60-year-old Harumi Takada sat at the very next table in the busy shop. She was eating with her elderly parents. Takata's husband left for Japan on Wednesday to attend his mother's memorial service.
And then next thing you know, this big earthquake. And I've been trying all morning contacting him. I can't get through. I don't know if he made it safely. I'm praying.
Friday afternoon, Governor Brown declared a state of emergency in San Mateo, Santa Cruz, Humboldt, and Del Norte counties. The earthquake triggered tsunami warnings up and down the West Coast. In Crescent City, just south of the Oregon border, large waves swept across the ocean, crashing into the harbor there. Coast Guard Lieutenant Todd Vorenkamp is stationed in Humboldt Bay.
Around 8 o'clock in the morning, a tsunami wave came ashore in Crescent City. The report I got was that it pulled the water from the harbor out about 1,000 feet from where it normally would be and then came into the harbor and damaged about 15 to 20 boats. Some structures received damage and some docks were damaged.
Crescent City was evacuated, but, says Lieutenant Vorenkamp, some people ignored the warnings.
And the report was that three men had gone down to the shoreline to take pictures of the tsunami waves and were all swept out to sea. Two of those three people made it ashore. One person did not make it ashore and is still unaccounted for, and the Coast Guard is still searching for him.
Vorenkamp noted that even under the best of conditions, the Northern California coast can be treacherous. He adds that tsunami warnings really need to be taken seriously.
When those warnings get issued, it's instead of heading towards the beach to sightsee, you need to get to higher ground, get away from the low-lying coastal areas, get away from the beach, and get to a safe place until the warning has ended. It's really not a good time to be sightseeing at all.
The tsunami's arrival onto the shores of California was warned and watched by emergency management officials here. The California Report's Sacramento Bureau Chief John Myers stopped by the state's Command Central, where spokesman Jay Allen said the early warning system appears to have worked.
We're dealing with Mother Nature, and as precise as some of the readings can be received and gotten from these buoys and sensors out in the ocean, It's a big ocean. There's still a lot of unknown to these things. I think the scientific models and predictions that we were given ahead of time as to the size of the waves, the amount of water, and where these would be most affected were fairly accurate. So that helps us plan and prepare, and obviously especially warn people to get away from the shore and institute those warnings, those tsunami advisories and warnings and those sirens and the police and law enforcement and others getting people to safety.
Talk a little bit about what state headquarters can do and what you do in the command center here. What do you do other than, you know, just hope that everything goes okay? How can you lead the charge?
Well, we try to be as forward-leaning as we can within reason. Like I said, the scientific modeling on this and the predictions were fairly accurate, so we can advise our local partners of that, which is part of our job. We can help coordinate response ahead of time, moving resources, people, fire trucks, law enforcement, those sort of things ahead of time. And that's what we do here at the State Operations Center, is basically try to get those resources where they're needed, when they're needed.
Would it be safe to say that what we know now, that Crescent City is probably the most dramatic example of impact of the tsunami waves?
I think so. The preliminary reports coming in here to the State Operations Center seem to indicate that. It's a little less of an accessible part of the state. But again, we have had help from other agencies. For instance, CAL FIRE had some planes in the sky, and they actually are actually the fire department in a number of coastal communities. So the state resources were as soon as we received the warning that this could happen, we started mobilizing overnight within, a few minutes and an hour or so of when the earthquake hit in Japan. And unfortunately, it does seem like the North Coast took the brunt of it. And we'll do our best to help people get back to normal as quickly as possible.
That's Jay Allen with the State Office of Emergency Services talking with Sacramento Bureau Chief John Myers. Friday's earthquake and tsunami are a reminder that in times of crisis, many people still turn to the radio for information, especially in rural parts of California.
We're an essential part of the safety net up here.
John Coate runs KZYX and KZYZ Public Radio. They serve Mendocino, Sonoma, Lake, and Humboldt counties.
We tell people when there are floods, when there are fires, when roads are closed, when really bad things happen, we just go, into 24/7 mode and report on it.
Not far from there, North State Public Radio covers Redding and Chico, but also more remote areas like Hayfork, Weaverville, and Oroville. North State's GM, Brian Terhorst, says folks there rely on public broadcasting during emergencies, like floods and wildfires.
We are the only place that people can go for that kind of information. A couple of summers ago, we had smoke coverage here for months on end while they were working on, nationally covered fires that were burning right here in our region.
In general, rural stations are more dependent on government funding than those in more urban areas. That said, as Congress threatens to eliminate funding for public broadcasting, even big market stations are concerned about taking a hit.
Understanding that we might be facing $1 million cut in KPCC's funding, House has already voted to do it. We don't know what's going to happen in the Senate. If you have not availed yourself of this opportunity, it's absolutely critical that we hear from you now.
In Los Angeles, KPCC-FM is putting efforts to cut public broadcasting dollars front and center during its spring fundraising drive. Ironically, a high-profile member of KPCC, Republican Congressman John Campbell from Irvine, is pushing to eliminate that government funding.
Yeah, you have to figure out, is that nice to do or is that have to do? Now, when it comes to the government funding of of public broadcasting. My view is that that's a nice to do because I think public broadcasting will stand on its own.
As a member of the House Budget Committee, Congressman Campbell recently voted to slash $61 billion in federal spending this year, including more than $450 million for public broadcasting. He thinks NPR and PBS would be better off without government support.
Then you're not accountable necessarily to those of us in Washington, and I would think that might actually be a better path for public broadcasting going forward.
The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, or CPB, was created when television was still relatively young and community radio stations were mostly obscure. When President Lyndon Johnson signed legislation creating the CPB in 1967, he said it would build that network of public stations to, as he described it, help enrich man's spirit.
It will try to prove that what educates can also be exciting.
Johnson went on to say that while it would be government-supported, public broadcasting should also be guarded from partisan control or influence.
It will be free and it will be independent and it will belong to all of our people.
Now, it would be a huge understatement to say this has not been a good week for public broadcasting, and NPR in particular. CEO Vivian Schiller resigned after NPR's chief fundraiser was caught on tape trashing the Tea Party and the Republican Party in general during a lunch with two men posing as associates of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Couldn't happen at a worse time.
D.C. lobbyist Steve Elmendorf advises Democrats and a wide range of corporate interests in Washington. He says NPR this week did its critics a huge favor.
It puts everybody on the defensive, and it puts, obviously, public broadcasting on the defensive, and it puts their defenders on the defensive.
On average, public radio stations rely on government funding for about 12% of their budgets. But as we noted earlier, federal funds can be up to half of the budget at smaller rural stations, like KIDE-FM, which serves the Hoopa Valley Indian Tribe in Northern California. John Boland is CEO of KQED Public Media in San Francisco, where the California Report is produced. Boland notes that if Congress eliminates that money, some of those small radio and television stations would have to significantly scale back their programming.
Then you don't have universal service. You're not reaching and serving everyone in the American public. And the whole system of interdependence and pooling our resources to create programming falls apart.
So far, the U.S. Senate has not voted on whether to eliminate CPB funding, and negotiations over the entire federal budget continue. In Sacramento, the state legislature is still debating Governor Jerry Brown's budget. Part of his plan to solve that deficit of more than $26 billion involves trimming funding for the state's firefighting agency, CAL FIRE. Originally, CAL FIRE was designed to protect the state's wild rural areas far outside of cities. But over the years, that distinction between rural and urban has become much less clear, as Amy Standen reports.
Not long ago, I went for a drive with Chief Richard Price of the San Ramon Valley Protection District. We headed out to a small, woodsy community on the outskirts of San Ramon.
You're seeing green hills today, so don't let that fool you. You know, in a couple of months, these will be golden hills and definitely ready to burn.
Still, it's easy to see why someone would want to live here. The houses are acres apart with views across uninhabited valleys, thick with oak trees. But just imagine, says Price, what would happen if a fire broke out?
You know, there's no fire station up here, and you've got these big trucks. It's steep, you know, steep drop-offs.
Houses here straddle an invisible line. On the one side is the town of San Ramon. On the other is what's called State Responsibility Area, or SRA. We get out of the truck and look out over the ridge.
So you can see this is SRA lands, and you can even see a home built down there in the canyon. You can feel the wind, and with the right temperature conditions, you get a dry day, and fire coming from this area would easily overtake this neighborhood.
If a fire breaks out there in the state responsibility area, it's up to CAL FIRE to fight it. If the burn is on the other side in the city limits, then the job falls to the local fire department. But there are houses on both sides of the line, and protecting them, says Chief Price, requires both agencies.
This is not an area that you can fight with fire engines. You need aircraft up here. And there's no aircraft in this area other than CAL FIRE resources.
In January, the governor's plan was this: gradually scale back those state responsibility areas to places where there are no homes at all, places that are truly wildlands. That, after all, is what CAL FIRE was designed to do, says H.D. Palmer, spokesman for the State Department of Finance.
We've seen a lot of encroachment in development into these areas, and one of the things that we proposed to do is to alter who was responsible or which entity of government was going to be responsible for wildland fire suppression and emergency response.
This idea had a lot of support from environmental groups like Sierra Club California, which Bill McGavern directs.
We think that those governments, the local governments that are expanding residential development into fire-prone areas, should be the ones to have to pay for the cost of fighting fires in those areas, instead of expecting the state taxpayers to always come to the rescue.
This proposal would have shaved roughly $250 million a year off the state budget, but it met resistance from counties, including Contra Costa, where property taxes have been down for 3 straight years.
We have had a hiring freeze for 3 years now, haven't hired firefighters for 3 years. As people leave, they're not replaced. And in reductions wherever we can make them, you know, it's difficult to reduce costs and not reduce service levels. And that's what we're always trying to do.
Last week, Governor Brown scaled back his proposal. Instead of shrinking CAL FIRE's area of responsibility across the state, he'll instead focus on just a few counties: Marin, Kern, L.A., Orange, Santa Barbara, and Ventura. Instead of saving $250 million a year, the state would save about $52 million. Again, H.D. Palmer from the state's Department of Finance.
Based upon the research that we did and the input we received, we determined that there was a better path going forward to focus on these 6 counties.
Palmer says there's another way that CAL FIRE can trim costs, too. It has to do with a policy that Governor Schwarzenegger put in place in 2004 after a series of massive wildfires scorched Southern California. The policy required that each fire truck be staffed with 4 firefighters instead of 3. This added $33 million a year to CAL FIRE's budget.
We looked at the issue of the 4th firefighter on the trucks, whether or not adding that additional firefighter on the truck materially change the response time for controlling wildfires in under 10 acres?
The answer was no. In fact, the analysis showed that adding that 4th firefighter actually decreased the response time by a couple of percentage points. It's not a significant difference, says Palmer, but it shows that the state can cut back on firefighters without affecting safety. But Carol Wills with the California Professional Firefighters, a statewide union, rejects that explanation. He says firefighters today have a different job than they did back in 2004.
In this day and age in California, it's pretty difficult to find an out-and-out pure forest fire. There's almost always some sort of structure close by or some small town or some new development.
More development in rural areas means tougher firefighting, he says.
More personnel is always going to lead to faster response times. And when you're fighting fires, whether it's in the wildland or in the urban areas, seconds and minutes count.
The state legislature is expected to vote on the governor's proposed budget by the end of the month. For the California Report, I'm Amy Standen.
This weekend, a celebration of music, storytelling, and troubadours marks its 200th show in Santa Barbara. The concert series, called Sings Like Hell, has highlighted up-and-coming singer-songwriters for the last 14 years. Reporter Diane Bach has more.
Ain't no reason things are this way. It's how they've always been and they intend to stay. I can't explain why we live this way. We do it every day. Preachers on the podium speaking the saints, prophets on the sidewalk.
The best music you've never heard. That's one of the taglines of Sings Like Hell, which recently featured musician Brett Denon.
I got a basket full of lemons and they all taste the same. A window and a pigeon with a broken wing. You can spend your whole life working for something just to have it taken away.
Peggy Jones is the series producer.
What I'm doing is I'm taking these mostly young or underknown, either singer-songwriters or bands who are just starting out or who have been around a while and for whatever reason have not gotten the notoriety that the quality of their music deserves, in my humble opinion. And I'm bringing them actually to this glorious venue, the Libero Theater, and kind of treating them like rock stars for a night.
There ain't no reason. Things are this way. It's how they always been and they intend to stay. And I don't know why I say the things I say, but I say them anyway. But love will come and set me free.
Sings Like Hell started out on Jones's ranch in the San Ynez Valley, a place about as far removed from the typical live music scene as you can get. Over 200 people would flock there to check out live shows. In August of 1997, Jones moved the concert series to the Libero, an intimate jewelbox of a theater rich in musical history with amazing acoustics to boot. Music critic Joseph Woodard, who's covered the Santa Barbara music scene for decades, has followed Sings Like Hell since the very beginning.
Yeah, it's funny how, I mean, we just accept it as hell. It's, you know, we don't think about the biblical implications, or at least I don't. It's just hell, and it's a happy place, the happiest place on earth.
I'm not here for your confession. We said all there is to say.
Ben Phillips has been a kind of a critical cog in this whole series. A great songwriter and singer, perfect as sort of a recurring motif.
Glenn Phillips of the band Toad the Wet Sprocket has performed for Sings Like Hell many times.
I still see you as you are for the tears beneath the scars. Kisses sweet and so rough. You will always have my love.
What a thing like this points out is that there is extremely worthy art that doesn't necessarily thrive in the grand market, but that is utterly worth hearing and utterly worth supporting.
A big part of the magic that is Sings Like Hell is supplied by the audience, which is largely composed of diehard subscribers who buy tickets to every show in the series.
Everybody shows up to listen, whether they're familiar or not. It's an audience that, you know, rather than leaning back in their seats and kind of forcing you to prove something and starting to chatter if you don't. They're expecting you to have some subtlety and have some worth, and they're willing to show up for it.
Hale Milgram, former president and CEO of Capitol Records, is the keeper of the Sings Like Hell audio archives.
It's become a real group that you look forward to getting together with, both out in the lobby when people are milling about at the intermission, as well as just sitting next to them and pinching yourself that you're getting to see this incredible talent that in a lot of cases you wouldn't know. An artist that just played the last show of Sings Like Hell, Chuck Prophet, and he's got his own style. He's an incredible guitarist.
And for founder Peggy Jones, the ultimate goal of Sings Like Hell is a simple one.
To keep people coming out to see live music. That's the deal. It's an unparalleled experience, that incredible, exquisite feeling that comes over you when you're in the presence of someone who's just playing their heart out.
For this 200th show, actor and Santa Barbara local Jeff Bridges will take to the Sings Like Hell stage to showcase his new album. He'll be joined by T-Bone Burnett and special guests. For the California Report, I'm Diane Bach in Santa Barbara.
And finally today, cleanup from the massive earthquake and tsunami in Japan is just barely beginning. In Haiti, they're still clearing rubble and rebuilding homes and schools more than a year after a magnitude 7 quake devastated that country. Well, now a small town in Northern California is helping out. As Christina Onestad reports from Ukiah, locals have rallied to help a small village of Haitian girls.
Inside the Ukiah Brewing Company, several folks gather over a pitcher of organic beer and run down a checklist of supplies for an upcoming relief trip to Haiti.
That brings me to water. Do we have access to water?
Yes, he said there were water bottles and filters.
One of the people at this table is Hadley Burkett, project manager for a Ukiah nonprofit called Heartstone Village.
I think food is the most basic need for these girls. Safety is another issue. Making sure that where they're living is safe and they're free from harm and they're not going to have people coming in there and taking their things away. I mean, it's just really basic human needs that we take advantage, I think, here.
Burkett's raising money for Heartstone's project to build a new girls' orphanage. It's a vision that Dr. Laura Wedderburn brought back from Haiti last year after providing medical relief to earthquake victims. Wedderburn, who's from the Caribbean, says after spending a week helping the earthquake victims last year, she became overwhelmed by so much need.
What did I really do? You know, who did I really help?
Wedderburn spoke with a Ukiah nurse who was with her in Haiti. The two of them came up with the idea that by helping an orphanage, they could make a lasting impact. Wedderburn says she talked with her translator about the idea.
And he said, well, I have my two daughters whom I can't afford to feed and clothe. I have them in an orphanage. Why don't we go there? So we, four of us, jumped into a taxi and went to the orphanage and found 20 girls. They looked well cared for and happy. They were singing with us through most of the afternoon.
But the three-story house had poor plumbing and cracked walls. They were catching rainwater to drink. Wedderburn and her colleague returned to Ukiah with a plan to adopt the orphanage and then started talking to local media, nonprofits, and anyone else they could draw into their vision, which turned out to be a lot of people. Social worker Ariella Marshall is picking up donations at the Mendocino College cafeteria for her trip to Haiti. She's already got stickers, chalk, books, art supplies, and toys, and it all has to fit in her duffel bag.
Soccer balls are very popular with them right now, so I have soccer balls, but those do take up a lot of space.
Marshall pulls the soccer balls out of her duffel bag to make room for donations of handmade dresses and aprons. The clothes come from a volunteer group called Hands Helping Haiti. Serena Miller founded the group. She shows Marshall the new items a volunteer made this month.
So Dorothy Bednar made these six aprons for the staff.
Miller says she was inspired by her grandmother, who was a seamstress.
And when she retired, she took old clothing that people dropped off on our porch all the time and reconfigured it and made it into clothes for an orphanage in Baja. I didn't even know that was going on in my unconscious until I got the project going.
The local support keeps growing. An organic farmer is setting up a gardening project at the orphanage, and Heartstone Village plans to start a pen pal project. Dr. Laura Wedderburn says this is solidarity, not charity, for the people in Haiti.
I think if we can raise a generation of children that can start their own factories, that can start their own schools, and can start their own trades, like we want the girls to start to learn how to sew so they can become seamstresses. Until we can do that, then we'll always be feeding the Haitians instead of them feeding themselves.
Volunteers from Ukiah continue traveling to Haiti each month to bring supplies and share skills. Heartstone Village has secured a donation of land and plans to hire Haitian workers to begin construction on the new orphanage this summer. For the California Report, I'm Christina Onnested in Ukiah.
And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our team includes Susie Racho, Seal Muller, Lillian Mongeau, Alexandra Wexler, Victoria Malleone, Gabriel Cohen, David Marks, Ingrid Becker, and Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, celebrating the 2011 recipients of the James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards. More information is available at www.irvine.org. The California Endowment, building healthy communities because that's where health begins. More information at calendow.org. And the SunPower Corporation, offering high-efficiency solar energy solutions to households and businesses in California and worldwide. The SunPower Corporation, online at sunpowersolar.com.